Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 47, The Phallus, a sacred symbol of creative energy. Based on a fascinating book called The Phallus, Sacred Symbol of Male Creative Power by Alain Danielou. Was translated by John Graham and published by Inner Traditions of Rochester, Vermont. It's going to be part one. Presumably two parts. On the back cover is a quote from Leonardo da Vinci. Man is wrong to be ashamed of mentioning and displaying it, always covering and hiding it. He should, on the contrary, decorate and display it with the proper gravity, as if it were an envoy. Monk, thank you for listening. I'm going to preface this show by saying it's a sensitive topic. It's a delicate topic because of the society and the culture and the programming that we live in. Even that I have to mention this kind of thing shows that, I mean, I don't have to, but I feel it's important to mention it because it's a topic that is not talked about. It is so, under the radar in a way that, it has that vibe to it that, oh, I gotta preface this with saying that going to be talking about the phallus and making sexual references, but you know, it's in the context, as the title of the book says, as a sacred symbol, and I think that's where the disassociation comes, due in a large part to the religiosity and the upbringing that we have, you know, that sex is dirty and bad and this and that. And, you know, there's sexuality, the act of sex, and then there's sexuality on much, much other levels. And as the book's title says, a lot of it is really about the creative power and creative energy. So many times the symbolisms and the artwork and the activities that are going to be cited are, they're as much metaphorical and symbolic as they are, quote, sexual. So this is a fascinating book. It's not that, sorry, pardon the puns, it's not that long. It's about 112, 115 pages with a glossary of Sanskrit terms, because many, many of the quotes in the book come from Sanskrit. There is a long tradition, presumably known, you know, by a lot of people who into esoterica in some degree, as the male form the lingam and the female the yoni. And those are prominent in India, outside of perhaps temples, and I'm not up on all the exact history. It should be mentioned in the book. So there's a lot of reverence there and elsewhere, as the book shows. Now, while this show is you know, featuring the phallus, I recently heard mention of sort of a balance, and I want to mention it to begin with, a DVD which I have not seen but just heard bits of, called Woman Shaman, the Ancients. And on the I'll put the link up with this show, on a page explaining, it says, it reveals a rich and long disregarded cultural record of medicine women, oracles, healers, trance dancers, shapeshifters, drummers, and dreamers, with commentary and music. I dug through libraries, journals, the internet, and my own archives to put together rare images of women's ceremonies in Saharan and Azerbaijani rock art, Hindus, tiger women, Spanish wolf women, and Zimbabwean lion women, ecstatic dancers in Chinese bronzes, Mexican codices, Cretan as in Crete, seals, shamanic sculptures from Ecuador and Japan and the Arctic. This unprecedented global view of female shamans uncovers overlooked depictions in rock art, sculpture, codices, bronzes, and ceramic paintings. The double disc set includes chapters on sacred dance, staffs, rattles, fans, and mirrors, flight, entheogens, not sure what that is, serpents, animal spirits, and goddesses with shamanic aspects. Now, mentioning that as a balance and also as a way of, interestingly, how it fits with the opening of this book. On the phallus, which begins, the cult of the phallus, the source of life and a symbol of virility, courage, and power, first appeared in the vast civilization that developed from India to the extreme edge of Western Europe at the beginning of the Neolithic era, following the end of the Ice Age about 8,000 BC. Closely tied to the bull and serpent cults, it has survived in India with its rites and legends intact to the present time, but its traces, symbols, and certain other cult elements can be discerned throughout not only all the civilizations of Mesopotamia, the Middle East, Egypt, and the Aegean, but also those of Thrace, Italy, and the entire pre-Celtic world, including Ireland. Which, of course, is interesting because Ireland, known as, you know, very heavily Catholic, probably some of these sections are going to be reading twice, because that was some of my first response when I read them was, you know, for real. And backtracking just a bit to the introduction, the phallus is really the image of the Creator in mankind, and we rediscover the worship of it at the origin of every religion. We rediscover the worship of it at the origin of every religion. A source of pleasure, the phallus evokes divine bliss, the being of joy. Within the microcosm of the living being, it represents the progenitor, which is always present in its work. Contempt for this sacred emblem, as well as degradation and debasement of it, pushes man from the divine reality. It provokes the anger of the gods and leads to the decline of the species. The man who scorns the very symbol of the life principle abandons his kind to the powers of death. That's a powerful statement. I think what he's saying is that, you know, by negating it, this is a symbol of life and creative energy. So by negating it, you know, one is denying the life force. And if we look at the world nowadays, we see where the denial of this has caused a lot of trouble. And before reading some more of the book, I just wanted to interject some, I guess, perhaps more personal observations of how I see the world and society, especially in the West, in America, and, you know, probably elsewhere, but that's mostly what I know of and see, is that the culture is a, I don't know, for lack of a better phrase, a kind of breast-dominated culture. The feminine is, the sexuality is glorified, whether it's through models, advertising, magazines, the sort of pampering to the feminine in that kind of form, with the, you know, the cleavage and on the news and in movies and in Hollywood and just so much is like the sacred symbol is this cleavage. You even call the television, you know, the boob tube. So it's in that contrast, the topic of the, you know, the sacred phallus, I find quite interesting, as see that as a culture and in the world we have, for the various reasons, gotten away from that. And so that's part of what this essence of this show is about, bringing that to attention and reviving respect for it, and, you know, not having to giggle at it or be like, we, you know, in third, fourth grade or whatever, the sex education, it was a giggle. And hey, I still giggle, but there's a deep level of respect, and also seeing that there's something truly real about this. I mean, even in some of the mythologies I've read of, you know, various cultures, it's the rain as seen as the masculine coming down to the earth and, you know, into the womb of the Mother Earth, and that makes things grow. So there's a constant kind of sexual metaphoricalness going on in the higher levels and in the way the world works. And the book is fascinating, has photos from around the world, one from ancient Egypt with a glyph showing Pharaoh's power of creation at the Temple of Karnak, exterior wall, Luxor. There's a pharaoh with a, you know, moderately sizable erection. And there's various sculptures, ancient Greece, the herms were stone sculptures, which were shape of a phallus, were often placed outside the temples or on the roadways as a way to, they were symbols of good luck and of, you know, guidance and blessing. The way I see it is, it's kind of like, you know, when you're excited to go somewhere or do something, it's a turn on. And that is one metaphor of, what these, phallic markers dotting the landscape, not just in ancient Greece, but in various other parts of the world, that it's a symbol of, you know, prosperity and fertility with the land. And here's a reference to, until very recently, phallic cakes were baked by German, French, and Italian peasants at Easter to be carried in procession to the church. At Trani by Naples, a huge wooden phallic image called Il Santo Membro was carried in procession annually until the 18th century. Now, just think about today, the kind of uproar, certain artwork was depicted. Again, that's another way the sort of the feminine and the boob culture has been revered in, you know, modern art. And going back to the, I'm not a art student as far as dates and all that, but, you know, the famous artists through the 1700s, 1800s, whatever, it's, you know, the feminine form is praised. And of course, yes, the feminine form is beautiful and should be praised, but so should the male form. And to kind of think about today, like, wow, what if we put up these phallic statues in the parks and along the streets? I think that it would be an uproar, and that to me is the sign of the where the culture has gone and gone away from this. So again, the purpose of this show, or one of the purposes. And you know, another mention here of the balance, the male and female principles, and I think this is coming from an ancient Hindu text. The symbol of the cosmic man, Purusha, the archetype, the universal plan present in all things, is the male emblem, the phallus. The symbol of energy, which is the world's substance, the generator of all that exists, is the female organ, the yoni. And another interesting section here, this is from the Shiva Purana, P-U-R-A-N-A. Pleasure in the Shaivite conception is the image of the divine state. That is why when the divine manifests itself in its procreative aspect, it shows its aspect as pleasure in equal degree. The sexual organ therefore has a double role, the inferior one of procreation and the superior one of contacting the divine state by means of the ecstasy caused by pleasure, ananda. The orgasm is a divine sensation. So whereas paternity attaches man to the things of the earth, the ecstasy of pleasure can reveal divine reality to him, leading him to detachment and spiritual realization. The phallus is the source of pleasure. It is the sole means of obtaining earthly pleasure and salvation. By looking at it, touching it, and meditating on it, living beings are capable of freeing themselves from the cycle of future lives. The last bit was the quote from the text, but I mean that, I'm going to repeat that statement. By looking at it, touching it, and meditating on it, living beings are capable of freeing themselves from the cycle of future lives. So that could be one reason why they don't want you to look at it, etc. And then again, the level of reverence from the ancient Indian culture, sperm is called Biga, Bija, the semen, Soma, the oblation, Chandra, the moon, and Virya, the virile essence. In Egypt, the sun god Ra Atomkhepre manufactured all of creation by masturbating. Now, that's not something they normally hear about in Mythology 101, and the yoni, a little bit on the yoni, the vulva or yoni here. The universal energy, the substance of the world, is represented by the yoni, which grasps the lingam. It is only when the phallus, the giver of semen, is surrounded by the yoni that God can manifest and the universe appear. So again, these things can be seen, from different levels. The yoni represents the womb of the visible and the subtle world, the universal womb in which all things that are individual develop. That bit's from the Upanishad, again, ancient Indian sacred text. And here there's a reference to, we've heard of the Oracle of Delphi. The very name Delphi stems from Delphys, D-E-L-P-H-Y-S, meaning womb. And I don't know if this is connected with the Kama Sutra type of thing, but again, from Chandogya Upanishad, the rituals that provide the means for us to communicate with the gods are interwoven with the act of making love. Quote, the first appeal is the invocation of the god. The invitation represents the louds. Sleeping next to the woman is the Magnificat. Facing one another is the choir. The orgasm is the consecration. Separation is the closing hymn. He who understands that every sexual act is a hymn addressed to Vamadeva, the fiery form of Shiva, recreates himself with each copulation. He will thrive all the days of his life. He will live long and become wealthy in both offspring and in livestock. Rich will be his renown. So here we have, you know, an example of whether it's, you know, whatever form, the male-female, male-male, female-female, that, you know, each one, each form has a sense of, to approach it with a sense of respect and reverence, and that the sexuality is connecting to a divine level, whether by yourself or with someone else. There's a divine thing going on there. And although it's heavily quoted with, ancient Indian, text, there is a pretty wide representation Here's another repeatable phrase. The idea of God the Father is a puritanical transposition of the divine phallus. The idea of God the Father is a puritanical transposition of the divine phallus. So there again is a sort of mind-blowing kind of thing. We have these stereotypical, you know, the Father God is this white-bearded old guy looking over us, and here it's being posed that perhaps, you know, the sort of archetypal essence of the Father is a phallus. So again, you know, you can make your own associations as to why this stuff is so suppressed. And many of the columns here, they refer to Greece. At Gnosis, as in Thebes and Malta, the god was honored in the form of a column. Everywhere the phallus cult spread, its presence is affirmed by the standing stones that can be found from India, Greece, Mesopotamia, Thrace, Crete, Malta, and Corsica to the very edge of Brittany and England. Dionysius is called Pedicionios of the column. So the book is just chock full with the references and photos of sculptures and the standing stones around the world and other images. Another section is to accentuates the nakedness, another thing in the culture that we are, you know, sort of a clothing addicted. I don't mean just the wearing of clothes, but you know, sometimes I drive around town and see how the clothing stores, and there's just like tons and tons and tons of clothes, even in one store, the amount of colors of the same shirts and the amount of shirts, and again, a cultural societal thing of having lost touch with our nakedness. And This section is called The Spirit of the Forests, the Lewd and Naked God. The gods and the prophets have been created naked. Every human being is created nude. That's from the Linga Puranya. Nudity represents a return to the primordial state. The identification of man and God with nature implies nudity. David danced naked in front of the ark. 2 Samuel 6:14. The true man is nude. It is the hypocritical and pharisaic religion of the cities that demands clothing. Shiva is naked, clothed in space. The sage and Shaivite monk wander the world naked and without attachments. Nudity is synonymous with liberty, virtue, truth, and holiness. The ancient atheist religion of India, Jainism, the rival of Shaivism in other regards, made similar demands of its faithful that they be naked. The Greek world was very familiar with its gymnosophists, naked ascetics who came from India, and the soldiers of Alexander who wished to follow the teachings of Indian philosophers had to disrobe. Nudity has a sacred and magic value. To sow your seed, go naked, strip to plow, and strip to reap. If you would harvest, all Demeter's yield in season. Thus each crop will come in turn. That's from Hesiod, his Works and Days. Ritual nudity is well known and widespread in ancient religions. Shinto priests purify themselves in nakedness, and it was in nakedness that Hebrew priests penetrated the Holy of Holies to signify their lack of ornamentation at the approach of the divine mystery. There are countless examples in Celtic literature where masculine nudity is closely connected with the warrior's trance. Celtic warriors went into combat naked. In the Irish mythological tale, The Destruction of Da Dirga's Hostel, the bird father of the king says to him, "A man stark naked who shall go at the end of the night along one of the roads of Tara, having a sling and a stone, he shall be king." Dionysus himself is also represented as a long-haired nude when he is not clothed in a saffron-colored monk's robe. So those are quite fascinating. You have the, you know, you realize the mention of Dionysius, who's known for the wine and partying, and but there's also him as a saffron, wearing a saffron colored monk's robe. So it's, you know, it shows the time and a place for each, and also perhaps the symbolism of the king going through the night naked is you know, a symbol of letting go of all of the material world and you know, dripping down to one's essence. And when one is naked, in a sense, that's as, you know, close to your divine divineness as you get as far as the physical trappings. Another fascinating section is shapeless objects called Bethels. Sometimes the presence of God can be felt in apparently shapeless objects, which are therefore considered lingams. This is the case of the rough stone adored under the name of Eros that Pausanias saw in Thespia, and also of the black rock of Mecca, the Makeshvara of the ancient Hindus. Bethel, a term of Semitic origin, meaning the house of God, is the contemporary appellation for those sacred stones worshipped in Arab countries before Islam as so many receptacles of divine potency. Such stones served as cult centers for the ancient Hebrews. Their worship was considered idolatrous by Moses, who ordained their destruction. With his head resting on such a stone, however, Jacob received in a dream the revelation of his descendant's destiny. He erected a monument of this stone, which became a place of pilgrimage. In equal measure, Joshua erected a stone as testimony of his pact with Jehovah. There's some biblical references, Genesis, Leviticus, and Joshua. Ireland's main idol was called Crom Cruaich, C-R-U-A-I-C-H, or Fallstone, and was surrounded by a dozen other menhirs, M-E-N-H-I-R-S. Those are standing stones, if I remember looking that up correctly. St. Patrick, who put an end to this cult, struck them with his cross, causing them to sink into the earth. At Camarilla in the Morbihan area, a Bethel that no longer exists was marked with a swastika. In Thespia, Eros was worshipped in the form of a Bethel until Praxiteles sculpted an image of him in the 4th century BC. The talking stones utilized by oracles are often aerolites, A-E-R-O-L-I-T-E-S, such as the black stone of Cybele, the Trojan statue of Pallas Athena, and that which the Dalai Lama receives from the king of the world. So again, this reference to the sacred usage, and also the you could see where it's gone out of the context and out of our reference point with Saint this mention. I don't, you know, sometimes, you know, Moses and Saint Patrick and these figures have a true or positive side, but in the way that they're, you know, depicted here and in how we sort of get to sometimes mindlessly following holidays, we have St. Patrick as putting an end to the cult and Moses destroying these stones. And so there's a great sense of, you know, puritanical sort of violent prudity that goes with the reaction to this wanton expression of the sacred symbols of sexuality. So that's really, in my opinion, the essence of why it is repressed and kept out of public view. The end of this first section also goes into some indirect representations of the phallus. It mentions the plow and the arrow and the altar fire. And, you know, nowadays we have the sort of Cupid, the cutesy angel shooting the arrow. But here he says the arrow, which evokes the creative organ that opens in order to fertilize, is a symbol of the number 5 because of the 5 arrows, which with the god of love attacks the 5 senses. Therefore, the arrow is symbolically linked to the underlying principles of sensorial perception and to the 5 elements. In the altar fire, in sacrificial rites, fire image of the destroyer is called its sign, its lingam. It is the light of Shiva. The altar represents the woman, the hearth hallowed. At the top of the altar is the yoni. The ritual flame is obtained by the rotation of a pestle in a wooden bowl. Fire obtained by friction is considered to be the progeny of sexual union. So again, yeah, things start to be very Freudian here with the rotation of pestle in a wooden bowl, but again, it's all part of this earth creation, the divine and the manifestation, the male and the female. And the plow. The plow conjures up fertilization. The plowshare, like the virile member, penetrates the furrow opened by the plow in the female earth. Sita, born of the furrow, is the wife of the god Rama in the Indian epic. And again, it's another way to read a lot of the epics and the myths as to see these as the named people are really representing, I think, a lot of times these functions or cosmic activities going on. The plow, which impregnates the field, evokes the union of man and woman, sky and earth. There is a linguistic family relationship between Langala, the spade, and Lingam, the phallus. On ancient vases discovered in Abruzzi, the plowshare has the form of a phallus. A Greek vase in a museum in Florence depicts a phallus-shaped plow carried by ithyphallic men. That's where section two, part two of this book begins, and a word I seemingly always have to look up to remember what it means, ithyphallic. And then the nudity part, section of nudity that was read, that is in the second part, so kind of jumped ahead a bit, but, you know, presumably we'll be able to cover most of the rest in the second part. May take another part to do it. So the book has lots of historical information, artwork, pictures of real places, multiculture, as again, that's what fascinates me too, perhaps most. One of the most things is that this is across the board. It is not like finding one ancient culture that happened to do this, but, you know, from places that we don't normally associate, you know, the Arabs, the Hebrews, Ireland, you know, I was personally much more familiar with India and ancient Egypt and Greece, where this is revered, but to discover all these other countries around the world, really shows how, the globe was quite different, you know, way back when. So that'll wrap it up for first part. One other mention, though, the book was originally published in France, 1993, and the translation copy, 1995. So has been out for a little while. And it's, you know, it seems like something that would have just come out yesterday, and it is one of the wonders that we have the ability to have this kind of information and the imagery and the photos. As it is out there, it's just you know, it's under the radar and you have to look for it. It is timeless, as the book shows. It goes way, way back, and it taps into these ancient cultures with ancient wisdoms. And you know, I think we need a lot of this today with the especially the plows and the vegetation, where much of the battles going on now are around preserving land and this sterile, genetically modified products that have been made, and people are trying to stop this. The big agribusinesses, Monsanto for one, and how far that has gotten from the sense of sacred. So the sexual and the reverence for that, the sensuality, the subtlety, the beauty of all that has you know, escaped a lot of the modern world. And that's part of what this show is about, is hopefully help us reconnect with that, some of that energy. And how you then go apply that is really up to you. You know, I think each person takes that energy, that whatever you want to call it, whether it's sexual or turned on, we use that phrase a lot, you know. I turned him on to this kind of music. And we know that means you're excited about it. Again, that's what those ancient, you know, the Herms and the standing stones and all these sculptures and statues along the roadways. And it's reminding us to be excited, to be, you know, have a purpose in what we're doing. And, in that sense, to whether we're traveling or staying home, to, stay focused, have a good time. Picking out a song to end up the show was a little bit tricky, but, not sure how long the piece is, so I may just play part of it. It's a wonderful CD with Carlos Santana and Mahavishnu John McLaughlin, Love, Devotion, Surrender. And the first song is A Love Supreme. So thanks again for listening, and take care and have a good one.